The scripture reading I've chosen for this morning comes from the translation from the New International Version of Mark chapter 6, verses 1 through 6. And it reads, Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things, they asked. What's this wisdom that he's been given? What are these remarkable miracles he's performing? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own town, among his relatives, and in his own home. He could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. He was amazed at their lack of faith. Now, before I begin, I did just want to say that the germination of this sermon came over the course of 9 innings of Yankees baseball, where Paul and I were commiserating over the performance of the Yankees. But look, I mean, if you are a Yankees fan, at least we got this going for us. So let me just make a few remarks about Mark. It's one of the earliest accounts of Jesus' life. It's the earliest of the 4 Gospels. And it's widely believed to be at least one source for the other synoptic Gospels, Matthew and Luke. And Mark, the author, is not one of the original 12 apostles, but he is believed to have worked closely with the apostle Paul and collected eyewitness accounts of the original apostle Peter related to Jesus' life. And his gospel is about reflecting how people react to Jesus' words and acts. The first 8 chapters, which includes the passage that I just read, are about the awe and the amazement that Jesus is evoking by his acts. And he gets one of 3 reactions: a decision to follow him, questioning without further action, or rejection. And that's kind of what we see today with faith. We have people who decide to embrace it, we have agnostics who are questioning, and we, of course, have atheists who have decided that the God thing is a farce and reject it. Now, personally, at bottom, I view faith as our path to truth. Truth, at least in one sense, being the sacred time and space where it becomes clear to us that the infinite and the ultimate, that is God, is manifesting in our earthly world. When we're still and undistracted by the illusory human world and present in the abundant order and beauty of life around us. It's what I find personally when I'm in deep, vulnerable love, or when I'm moved to tears by the perfection of a musical performance, or when I've sat in a cinder block prison visitation room with someone who's committed a horrific murder and felt a deep connection with that person, notwithstanding her unspeakable acts. Now, today I'm going to talk about truth, or what Jesus reveals to us in the form of his miracles. And in the course of deeply examining your Christian faith, I think you inevitably get around to trying to figure out how you feel about miracles. You struggle with the resurrection, you struggle with suffering, and ultimately, you get around to miracles. And my view is that we do a great disservice to our ancestors if we just toss the miracle stories aside. These are things that were really meaningful and included in the gospel accounts for a reason. If you just discard them because they seem to be inconsistent with what we now believe we know about natural law, I think you're missing out on some important things. First, while we've made enormous progress in our understanding of nature, our knowledge is still extremely limited. Second, if you just toss them aside, you're unfairly presuming that even very strong evidence of something highly improbable must be unreliable. And third, and maybe most important, you're not allowing for anything occurring that's incapable of human explanation or description. That's a sad and confining world, where notwithstanding the vastness of the ever-expanding universe, we're unwilling to accept that things may occur that are inexplicable by us. In the Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky writes, "The genuine realist, if he is an unbeliever, will always find strength and ability to disbelieve in the miraculous. And if he's confronted with a miracle as irrefutable fact, he would rather disbelieve his own senses than admit the fact." So how in our modern age, when we believe we're so advanced in our science and technology, and we are, how do we think about the truth in and of miracles that were performed by Jesus, as recounted in the gospel, and what is or was their purpose? Everything Jesus did had a deep purpose in revealing truth to us. So what was the purpose of his miracles? And should we think of them literally, or are they metaphorical illustrations by the gospel writers, or are they both? Why was it even necessary for Jesus to perform miracles? Could he not have simply imparted his radical message during his ministry and then returned from the dead? Why did he have to gild the lily with all those miracles? Well, I'll start with just a brief summary of the miracle stories in the gospel, and then I'll give some thoughts on how we might think about them and how we might think about miracles we experience in our modern lives. And finally, I'll share some observations on the truth to be found in miracles. That is, what does a miracle reveal to us about what is universal and fundamental to human existence? So depending on which of the four books of the gospel you read, you'll find different miracles and differing frequency with which Jesus performed miracles. John, for example, reports on 7 of Jesus' miracles, including the raising of Lazarus, which, by the way, is the only book where that miracle occurs. But John, at the end, in chapter 21, says, "There are also many other things that Jesus did. If every one of them were written down, I suppose the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." And the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they each report between 20, 22 miracles. And depending on how you count, you sort of come up with something around 36 miracles that Jesus performed in the aggregate across all 4 books of the Gospel. Now, he performs his miracles for others, the sick, the lame, the destitute, not for his own benefit. And they generally fall into 5 categories. Healing some physical health issue would be the most obvious, like an illness or a disability, the things a medical doctor or the course of nature might accomplish today. Healing a mental health issue, like what they called being possessed by a demon or having an unclean spirit, the things a therapist or a psychiatrist might do today. Raising the dead on a few occasions. Today, we might think of this as reports of human beings who have flatlined and come back to life and reported their brush with death, or humans coming out of comas. Feeding the hungry with limited resources, something our homeless shelters and our churches do today. And then there's the mind-bending stuff, the one-off stuff, you know, which has been called like controlling nature, like walking on water or calming a storm or making a fig tree wither. And my personal favorite, turning water into wine at the wedding party in Cana, reported in the 2nd chapter of John. Now, there are several different models for thinking about Jesus' miracles, and I'll cover some of them. This is by no means exhaustive. At one end of the spectrum, you have the literalist view, the notion that the Gospels report on Jesus' miracles literally, word for word, infallible fact, and that the way that we interpret them today is the exact same way that they were intended to be interpreted by Greek scribes 2,000 years ago. That view would leave no room for condensing events that occurred over several months or years into a single paragraph, or for the gospel writer conveying a powerful message without adhering to precise fact. Now, toward the other end of the spectrum is the miracle as illusion view, the notion that the circumstances at the time of Jesus' ministry were ripe for his message and guidance. The folks he was ministering to, including his apostles, by the way, were open-minded, uneducated, illiterate people of faith with simple, beautiful lives. And miracles at that time were invariably accepted as a sign of the divine, and Jesus just yielded to the ideas of the time, performing illusions and sleight of hand, and in good faith, as a rhetorical method. Now, under that view, the gospel writers wrote what they saw and what they believed, or what other witnesses in good faith reported to them, but there, in fact, was no supernatural act that occurred. Okay, so that's the second view. The miracle as illusion. Third view, miracle as enticement. That these mind-bending miracles were inserted in the gospel as a technique by the authors to draw the reader in as a rhetorical method, enticing the reader to read and reread and interpret over and over again the message of Jesus. And the fourth view is the miracle as message. That is, when Jesus is reported to have performed a miracle, it's not what it may appear to be on the surface. For example, when Jesus feeds the 5,000, which is reported in all four books, with 5 loaves and 2 fish, the miracle is not, in fact, that the bread and the fish are endless or are literally multiplying as they get distributed, but rather the miracle is the community of humankind. What's possible when we love our brothers and sisters? What is our human potential when we put aside what I'm due or what I need for the benefit of a neighbor? The message being that you'll need less of what we're told we need in order to feel whole and complete and satisfied. When Jesus is reported to have walked on water, you might say that true faith is so powerful as to cause men to see Jesus walking on water, to see something we otherwise believe is impossible. These are not acts to demonstrate Jesus' power for the purpose of convincing us to worship him. In fact, they're not about Jesus' power at all. They're about our power. In Matthew chapter 9, verse 22, when a sick woman is healed after touching Jesus' coat, he says, "Take heart, your faith has healed you." He does not say, "I have healed you." He says, "You have healed yourself." Jesus' miracles are what we see and do and how we act and feel when truth is revealed to us. Let me just drop a footnote here on a philosophical point that I don't have time to get into. But we could have an interesting debate on whether it's any less miraculous that a group of people believed that they saw Jesus walk on water with their own eyes than that he physically defied nature by doing so. Anyway, I'm going to focus on the miracle as message, which to me must at least be a significant purpose of a miracle. So what are we to make of these miracles? And if you accept that miracles can occur, what was their purpose when Jesus performed them? And what is their purpose now, if you believe miracles still occur? Now, before we can even start talking about miracles, we need to define what a miracle is, because language and definitions matter, particularly when we're trying to talk about stuff as complex as the notion of God and Jesus and our faith. We should consider whether we've witnessed miracles or whether they're events that only occurred 2,000 years ago. Should we think about Roger Bannister's sub-4-minute mile in 1954 to be a miracle? Or the Moroccan runner who in 1999 ran a 3-minute, 43-second mile? Until 1954, we believed it was physically impossible for a human being to run a 4-minute mile. And now we believe it's physically impossible to run a 3-minute mile. Does that mean when someone does it, it will be a miracle? Should we think about miracles as events that cross over the line and the range of what we believe is possible and what we believe is impossible in natural law? We're learning so much every day about crazy things like neuroplasticity and how even late in our adult years, brain structure is literally changing shape and neural networks are forming and changing, and people are regaining use of previously paralyzed limbs, regaining eyesight after blindness or hearing after a sudden hearing loss, or leading relatively stable lives notwithstanding mental illness. Sports Illustrated last month in an article on quarterback Tom Brady, who's playing at 44 years old, reported that scientists now believe that the first person to live to be 150 has already been born, is walking the earth or crawling on the earth today. So that all seems pretty miraculous. I mean, is this the sort of thing that people called a miracle 2,000 years ago, but we just now say is producible with medical or technological intervention? Do we put that outside the definition of a miracle because these are things that can be brought about by humans and don't require God? And by the way, how do we even know when God plays a role and when it's human only? What about the impact of meditation, or what one might even call prayer? We now know that it can change the structure of the brain. Researchers are learning how to relieve intense chronic pain through emotional therapy and mental awareness. There's no medical intervention there. Scientific American recently reported on new findings on the physiological benefits of storytelling. The study showed that when children in pediatric intensive care units were told stories or engaged in riddle games, their pain levels went down, their stress hormones went down, and the hormones associated with positive feelings and empathy went up. I mean, what did Jesus do? He drew us in. He caused us to focus. He told parables and preached. He took us outside of our earthly world in a profound way. So given all that we've seen we're capable of, you can see why defining what a miracle is so difficult. Are these miracles or just scientific breakthroughs? Were these things possible 2,000 years ago, and now we're just using our human ability to recreate them and observe them and measure them? The best definition I've been able to come up with, which works well enough for my purpose, is that a miracle is a desirable event or outcome, the probability of which, in natural law, we deem so low that the most likely explanation is that it's the result of divine manifestation. A desirable event or outcome, the probability of which we deem it so low in natural law that the most likely explanation is that it's the result of divine manifestation. Now, let me just explain this definition a bit, because as you may sense from all of my questions, I'm not certain of much of anything here. Under the definition that I propose, improbable is intended to mean that given our general and specific historical experience and what we believe we know about natural law, there's an infinitesimal likelihood that the event or the outcome will occur. But since we don't know the full scope of what is possible under natural law, and we may be mistaken about things we believe we know about natural law, I've avoided a definition that relies on the event or the outcome being inconsistent with natural law. I've also avoided the certainty in the definition that it in fact was the result of divine manifestation, because again, if we don't know the full extent of what's possible in natural law, we can't say with certainty that the event was the result of divine manifestation. But if you do believe in an omnibenevolent God in Christian theology, you must believe that God manifests in our world or in our reality, and that the divine grace of God is possible. And if it's possible, well, then it would at least seem plausible, if not probable, that an omnibenevolent God manifesting in our experience is the most likely explanation for certain unlikely but desirable events. Otherwise, we're sort of left with a model of God as watchmaker. That is, he just made the universe in natural law, let it run its course without any further manifestation by him. That, however, is entirely inconsistent with our Christian faith and Jesus' teaching. So I prefer something closer to C.S. Lewis's definition of a miracle, which he describes as something occurring outside of the closed system of natural law, not something inconsistent with natural law. Natural law being what we believe to be the repeatable pattern in which the universe operates, whether we understand why or not. Like if one whose legs are paralyzed regains use of her legs, that's not the ordinary pattern in which nature operates. 2,000 years ago, that was the case too. We didn't know why, but we certainly knew that this was the state of nature. We now know about neurological physiology, and therefore we have theories explaining why paralysis doesn't usually heal, but we knew as much about the pattern of nature 2,000 years ago as we do now. And while natural law seems to provide a repeatable pattern, it's not the universe of possible results. It's only what we perceive to be that pattern. So when we say that a miracle is something that occurs outside of natural law, we mean that it's an occurrence outside of our experience, our interface with the universe. It's inconsistent with what normally happens in our reality because it derives from something outside of our reality. So if you accept the possibility that we can experience the divine in our world, that is God manifesting in our world, when does that happen? Why does that happen? And what do Jesus's and God's miracles reveal about universal truth? One logical place to start would be to consider what Jesus himself says about the meaning of his miracles. I went to the gospel, looked for that, and there's actually not a lot in there. Jesus doesn't talk about why he performs miracles, except that he doesn't want to use them to convince people that he's the way, the life, and the truth. In characteristic selfless, egoless humility, he tells his disciples and others not to report what he's done. Miracles are not about demonstrating his prowess. They're not performed for money or to win friends and influence people. They're acts of love, charity, and compassion. They're born of faith and hope and belief. It's not like Jesus's MO is to give a gift of a miracle as a quid pro quo once someone's testified to his truth, or that he performs a miracle in response to a challenge, or to convince people he has special powers or is the Son of God. No, he refuses to do that. It's a demonstration of God manifest in the truth of love on earth. It's a revelation, revealing that our peace and happiness, our joy in our earthly existence, isn't about demonstration of power or prestige. It isn't about giving in exchange for something in return or getting what I'm due. It's not about our ego. In John, when Jesus changes water into wine, he does it in private with the servants. The bridegroom gets all the credit for saving the best wine for the end of the party. Jesus doesn't make a big production of it, drawing attention to himself. He's happy to do it without any involvement of his own ego. And after that, John reports that Jesus was in Jerusalem, where he's reported to have driven the merchants and the money changers out of the temple. And John reports many believed in his name because they saw the signs that he was doing. Because they saw the signs that Jesus was doing. But Jesus, on his part, would not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to testify about anyone. For he himself knew what was in everyone. That's saying that our nature, which Jesus knows, is to believe that what we perceive as reality with our eyes and our ears is the source of our faith and where God manifests. But that's a backward way of looking at the source of our faith. Our faith comes from that which cannot be seen and heard. Our faith cannot be conditioned upon being given signs or miracles. If it were, it wouldn't be faith. Faith needs to come first, and only then does the evidence of God come. There's this beautiful concept presented by American psychologist and philosopher William James, who was the father of American psychology and an early member of the philosophical pragmatist movement. And the concept is called the will to believe. Many of you may have heard about this. It was presented in a lecture in which William James was responding to a statement by 19th century English philosopher William Clifford, where Clifford said, "It is wrong always, everywhere, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence." That was Clifford's claim. In James's response, he disagrees. He says, "That depends on your goal. Are you trying to avoid error, or are you trying to discover truth? Your goal matters, and you should ask yourself that question before deciding what to believe. If you're trying to avoid error, Clifford's right. The job of scientific research is to avoid error. We do not want unsafe airplanes flying passengers around. And we want to be very sure before a drug is approved for sale that it does reliably what it's supposed to do and it doesn't have any unknown side effects. But if truth is your primary goal, as opposed to avoiding error, James says we are justified in believing before we have evidentiary proof. In those situations, the proof only presents itself after believing. Don't let anyone convince you that you need scientific evidence before you're justified in believing what you know to be true. You are absolutely justified in having faith without having scientific proof in advance. The fear of being deceived will leave you paralyzed when you're seeking truth. As examples, James says, in questions of morality and personal relations, one is better off not waiting for definitive evidence to support the decision. If I had waited for proof of love with my wife before marrying her because of fear of error, rather than acting on my heart or what James would call your passion instinct, I would never obtain the evidence because the proof only comes after I've acted on that passion. By allowing myself to love and be vulnerable, not by creating some sort of business school decision matrix before I decide I love her. The true love comes only once I've allowed myself to be fully exposed. Another great illustration of this is the athlete. The athlete must believe she can prevail over an opponent, even in the face of overwhelming evidence that she'll lose. The evidence won't present itself until after she has prevailed. And her prevailing is precisely because of her belief. And the evidence of God manifest in our world only comes after you have enough faith to allow yourself to see it. If you watch sports, particularly individual sports as opposed to team sports, where the success of the athletic performance is entirely on one person's shoulders, you see how often those athletes, praise God, boxers, wrestlers, fighters, swimmers, divers. So many athletes know that what they accomplish does not come from them alone. They know that once they commit to their faith, the evidence shows itself. Things become possible that we previously thought were not possible. It's the same thing with Jesus' miracles. Jesus said to Thomas, "Have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." He's skeptical of those who believe only because they've seen what he's done. Those folks have not yet understood that the efficacy of the miracle is the faith in what is hidden to the earthly evidence. Things like love and community, hope, beauty, just to name a few. And until we tap into that, no evidence of the grace and the glory of God will ever present itself, and we won't experience the miracle. You wait for conclusive evidence at your peril. Jesus in John chapter 10, verse 25 says, "The miracles I do in my Father's name speak for me, but you do not believe because you are not my sheep. My sheep listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me. You must choose Jesus first on faith, or the miracles will never be enough for you." He's not using these miracles to persuade. They're not rhetorical devices. He's opening a world revealing to those who have faith first in seeking truth, seeking what is real, divine, sublime, and the source of life-sustaining energy on earth. If you don't have faith first, the miracle will be ignored or explained away. Matthew, like Mark in the passage I read at the outset at chapter 13, reports that in his hometown, Jesus didn't do many miracles because the people there could not have faith in and even took offense at a carpenter's son preaching. The faith comes first. You'll never have faith if you wait for the evidence first. Our earthly existence is a constant distraction from truth. And there are a lot of powerful influences that want us not to seek truth. These are forces that see human beings as means to their ends, rather than the well-being of humanity as the end in and of itself. Once we're motivated by truth-seeking, we grow into peace because we start paying attention to God's gift of our natural environment and all life form around us. We start deeply caring about the well-being of the least powerful and the most destitute, because we realize that they are one with us. And we start devoting more time to giving rather than taking. When all of that happens, we're no longer tools used to achieve the goals of other people, and we act as if we're tools of God and here to love and serve God's creation, not man's creation. You'll hear people define faith as believing something without the evidence. That's not it. It's believing something before the evidence presents. If you want to see miracles, put your faith into action. Act as if you were here to serve humanity and love humankind. Act as if you believe that what we see right in front of our eyes is not the limits of the universe, and that all life form is one with us. Give to and receive from as if you have faith that we're not working against each other, but we're navigating this complex world together. Don't do it for an earthly reason or a justification. Do it for faith. What will begin to emerge is an existence you thought was impossible, and it will be miraculous. Amen.